Reverend, Reverend, please come quick. I got something to admit. I met a man in the sticks, a good old miss. He drove a Series 10 Cadillac and wore a cigar on his lip. Don't you know the devil wears a suit and a tie? Driving down the 61 in early July, white as the cotton field and sharp as a knife. I heard him howling as he passed me by. And he said, I know you, I know you, young man. Well, I know you by the state of your hands. You're a six-string picker, just as I am. Well, let me learn you some. I know a few tunes to make all the girls dance. Don't you know the devil wears a suit and a tie?
That guy's good.
Oh, that's somebody named Coulter Wall.
Yeah, I've never heard of him. He's great.
What was his name again?
Coulter Wall. W-A-L-L.
Coulter Wall.
He was, I got him off of Delfest link as a guy who was playing there at some point.
I don't remember him playing.
But anyway,
must have been on one of the small stages.
Well, he sounded like I don't know, from across the country, but in West Virginia, from my home here in near Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. And my good friend J.B. Christensen is also president of our regional labor council. And we've been doing this radio program for long time off and on now, but a good friend from Chicago, Scott Marshall, a retired steel worker, and a leader of the retirees, and now I think traveling around organizing more retirees because that's the problem with retirees. You got to keep replenishing that group because they, you know, they get tired after a while. Anyway, We're having that challenge here in West Virginia at our institute, and myself, John Case. So this is the Labor Beat Radio program, and today I want to take up a bit of a controversial question. I think first I'm going to read or summarize an excerpt and summarize from a statement from Bloomberg Philanthropies, where Michael Bloomberg, former mayor of New York, I think that I can't tell where his rank is right now. A year or so ago, he was the fourth richest man in the world. Also a candidate for president as a Democrat, a pretty major opponent on, although he'd been a Republican for most of his life. He joined the anti-Trump brigades early for the billionaires, actually. But he's probably a major funder of Johns Hopkins University's research and development, and maybe the biggest funder, actually. And at the same time, he's taken a big role in donating a lot of money. I think it was almost $50 million to the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign, and now has more than doubled down on that by donating $500 million to that campaign. And let me read a little bit of the statement that they made on this. It's actually now called the Beyond Carbon Campaign. We'll continue to work towards shuttering all remaining U.S. coal plants, quadrupling the amount of energy on the grid, and halving gas use by 2030. New funding builds on previous Bloomberg Philanthropies investments that catalyzed public and private efforts to accelerate the energy transition and meet ambitious climate goals. Today, UN Special Envoy and Climate Ambition and Solutions, Michael R. Bloomberg, announced an additional $500 million commitment to expand the Beyond Carbon Campaign, one of the largest philanthropic efforts to fight the climate crisis in the U.S. Beyond Carbon will turbocharge the efforts of U.S. cities, states, businesses, and more to transition away from carbon pollution. By 2020, Beyond Carbon aims to finish the job on coal, with 372 of 530 coal plants announced to retire or close due to date, more than 70% of the country's coal fleet. This next phase will shut down every last U.S. coal plant. Two, slash gas plant capacity in half and block all new gas plants. Three, increase U.S. clean energy fourfold. And there are, you know, have a number of strategies that are outlined in the proposal as well, you know, that including where to focus spending on data and research, on litigation, on policy and advocacy, clean energy deployment, coal refinancing to push for early retirement of coal assets, and implement the Inflation Reduction Act to ensure effective use of coal transition financing. In all of this statement, there are testimonials from folks like Abigail Dillon, president of Earth Justice, the Reverend Lennox Yearwood, president and CEO of the Hip Hop Caucus, Ben Jealous, executive director of the Sierra Club, and others. Okay. There is nothing in the official proposal, there isn't a comment about what the transition means for coal miners. Okay, and I'm just going to just leave it at that, okay, because there's a lot of headline stuff about the environmental stuff. Now I want to just read a little excerpt from Cecil's statement, if I can find it here. Just had it. Oh, here it is. Okay. Commenting on the announcement that Michael Bloomberg is donating $500 million to fund a campaign to prematurely close every coal-fired plant in the United States, UMWA International President Cecil Roberts issued the following statement. Michael Bloomberg has coal miners, their families, and their communities in his sights once again. Not satisfied to have killed tens of thousands of their jobs in the last decade, devastating families and communities throughout America's coal fields, he and the environmental groups who do the actual dirty work for him have decided the time has come to wipe them all out for good. The United States and much of the world are in energy transition, the devastating cost of which is placed squarely on the backs of traditional energy workers and their families. The UMWA has proposed ways to accomplish a true transition that changes that dynamic and does not leave these workers behind. We have worked with responsible parties inside and outside of government in an effort to move forward while protecting our members, their families, and their communities. They agree with us that there will be no justice in this transition unless workers and their families are put first. Mr. Bloomberg's announcement makes no mention of what will happen to the workers and their families. It makes no mention of the devastation he has already brought to Appalachia and elsewhere, which is now doubling down on. He makes no provision to help workers by providing training opportunities or incentives for new job creation in the coal fields. Anyway, he goes on. So I think I wanted to just leave it at that and as an opening. And you know, but both of you all had some thoughts, I know, in the preparation here. I hope you can, you know, improve or repair upon them now. So I'm going to go first with JB, since I know he's not as strong, but he's a very active environmentalist, both in his local community and in his advocacy. JB.
Yeah, good morning, John. As I alluded to earlier, I think this transition is critical for the survival of the human race in this climate crisis that we're in. There's no other way to look at it. I do believe that the workers should be taken care of, you know, very much worker oriented person, but you know, the jobs will be different. The jobs will have different training, different outcomes. The workers will be happy. You know, these jobs are much easier and cleaner than working in a coal mine or drilling a well somewhere. But the consequences of the fossil fuel industry for just reckless abandon on our environment is they're going to lose jobs. You know, that's the consequence, and they're going to pay fines. We have a governor in West Virginia who is a coal baron. They say he's a billionaire. He's best friends with Donald Trump. And he owns the Greenbrier, which is, you know, an exclusive resort club, golf club in West Virginia, while, you know, half of the population is very poor or very low middle class. It's just not right. And this is Cecil, you know, very, very opinionated. He's probably one of the best speakers I've ever seen in my life. Just very passionate about Appalachia and the coal miners and the coal miners' families. I get that, but there's a brighter tomorrow. And I just hope that he understands that it takes this kind of money, $500 million, or it's $500 million, correct?
He's Bloomberg's donating $500 million to the Beyond Carbon campaign, which is a Sierra Club pan campaign, but it's one that he is primarily financing right now.
Right. You know, I mean, it takes money to win these campaigns, and you know, the environmental community has been fighting this for 20 years. And you know, they've gotten some success, but we need total changeover to non-carbon fuels. That's just the way it is. I mean, it seems like an insurmountable task, but so did landing on the moon. It can be done. So that's my two cents. I think that Bloomberg did the right thing with this, but he neglected the workers. And for that, I'm upset. You know, he should have done more for workers, but I think they're all going to survive. They're all smart enough to learn a new trade, and you know, just better themselves over time. Like so many others have been in the history of the United States of being replaced by, you know, a new technology. And that's my piece.
All right. Scott.
Yeah. You know, first I wanted to make a point about Cecil. Cecil is an incredibly important labor leader, and he has championed a just transition from coal and oil to sustainable kinds of energy for a long time. And people should know that he is part of the leadership of an organization, the labor, I think it's called the Labor Committee for Sustainability or something like that. He's a big champion of that. And the reason he is part of that is because that group is fighting for a just transition and fighting for the idea that all of these workers should go to an equally lucrative job, and et cetera. And another point I want to make is that, you know, I think we all know that there's currently a huge strike against by the UAW against the big three. And, you know, one of the things that has come up, and I've been to rallies. We have a huge Ford assembly plant in Chicago, and I've been to rallies there. And one of the things that keeps coming up is that, you know, cars are a huge part of the problem. And they are more and more getting the idea that part of a just transition is to move over to making electric cars. And one of the big demands that they're making is that these electric batteries and car makers build their factories in pro-union states, not anti-labor states. And they are stressing that that the transition to electric cars could put all of these workers back to work and really be a just transition. And so they, you know, they even have a clause that they're demanding in one of their contracts, I don't know if it's all three or whatever, but that these plants only be built in pro-union states, and that immediately they become members of the UAW. So I think that's a really important aspect of a just transition. That's it.
Yep. Well, the one sentence in Cecil's remarks kind of stood out for me. That speaking of, we have worked with responsible parties inside and outside the government in an effort to move forward while protecting our members, their families, and their communities. They agree with us that there will be no justice in this transition unless workers and their families are put first. But so my question is that, you know, succeeding in the battle to reverse climate change, at least reverse dangerous trends, is an effort that I don't think a society, you know, that's divided with the levels of wealth and poverty in this one, as this one is, and has increasingly become. I don't think it'll ever get there unless there is some national unity. And I don't think there's going to be national unity if it's okay to leave people behind. You know, you all have, look what happened to the Rust Belt, so to speak. This is a big story, and I don't mean to oversimplify it, but certainly an important part of what happened in the Trump movements with the outrage, you know, at the establishment, so-called, and a Baker comes along. And well, this is a lot having to do with the transition to globalization and the loss of manufacturing in the United States. You know, we left a lot of people behind, and they didn't, you know, and they didn't join the you know, the overall improvement in standard of living for some others as a result of the tech revolution and low prices from global resources, labor, cheap labor. And so, you know, they didn't complain about it. But at the same time, this big cancer, you know, was of all these lost families. And I remember seeing evidence of it in many places in the labor movement, you know, so in the shops, which we were trying to organize. So I just, you know, I think Cecil has a point, you know, and that the families come first. Now, you know, in history, that hasn't always been the case. We know that. And in industrial transitions, you know, it's really been like a treated like a force of nature. It comes through, you know, it's like some people argue against climate change saying, oh, well, it's just weather killing people. It's been killing people for millions of years. And so it'll probably keep doing it for a while. Who cares? You know, force of nature, you know, nobody can do anything about it. Kind of attitudes. All right. But you can, you know, find, you know, lots of people searching for solutions and no incentive whatsoever to save anything when no one's looking after them. So I think, I don't know whether the whole system will go this way or that way, but I think from my life in the labor movement, if you don't fight against people being left behind, you lose everything in the end. Or you can. And I think a lot of times you do. That's just my feeling.
I agree totally. It's an ongoing fight, and it's one we have to make. And you know, I want to stress another point about the ongoing movement. Look at how many young people are getting involved in all of these fights. You know, I have retirees who say to me, what's going to save us all is Gen Z, because they are stepping up to the plate. They're organizing, but they are totally on board with a just transition and with moving away from carbon and, you know, all that stuff. And I just think that that's, you know, I have optimism about this, because I do think a fight back is really developing. And I think the labor movement is pretty united on this, even though there's some who don't agree. But I do think that they are more and more united on this. And, you know, you just look at all the organizing that's getting done. I mean, all these unions that are being built and all these massive strikes that are being really won by labor is really an uptick that moves in the right direction on all of these issues, I think.
I haven't seen the data on increases in membership. I mean, there's a lot of campaigns, and the strike wave is unbelievable. I mean, California now with the healthcare workers, and I see Mack trucks. I guess they decided to, even though they weren't called to go out, they went out.
Well, they didn't approve of the contract. They didn't think it was good enough.
Right.
That's why they went on strike.
No, I know that's why they went on strike, you know, but I remember, there was some release of Sean Fain was had wanted them to coordinate the timing, you know, they would.
Yeah.
I don't know, but it didn't matter. It was actually, yeah. I mean, I read Sean Fain's when he actually said when it happened was that, you know, it's an inspiration. It shows that there's this, you know, huge amount of support from the members for getting serious reform. So, and some serious money too. The spirit on the picket lines here in Martinsburg is good. I mean, nobody's sitting around not talking. Everybody's talking. I mean, they all got interesting, different ideas, but it's, you know, everyone's standing up. So I think that's a great thing. I don't see how you got that kind of force going. I think the other side's getting a wind of it. I think the concession sounds from Ford and GM on the electric battery plants is a great signal. But they still got to bring it home. I'm sure there's issues there. Also, you got to keep sight of the fact that the global economy is unstable.
Yep.
And there can be things that can happen that nobody here can do really anything about. It's not clear what the impact of the Israeli Hamas attacks and counterattacks now. It's not clear what impact that's going to have. If it follows historical patterns, well, this oil price will, you know, Saudi Arabia will not be able to reach an agreement and will probably will be back over $100 a barrel. And that's going to cause a problem.
Yep.
You know, that's just one of the things. Okay. And I see that the former Republican council of leaders of the former CEAs, you know, chiefs of the Council of Economic Advisors, calling for a massive increase in the military budget. Yeah, so you got a lot of volatility going on there. And I don't know whether Biden's going to be able to stay on top of it or not. I have a great fear that the foreign policy, you know, keeping the dominant U.S. position in the world and foreign policy is going to end up, you know, ruining everything that he's tried to do domestically. That's my fear, because that's what happened. That's happened before to us in our lifetimes. That's what happened to Johnson. You know, he's so engaged, you know, and decided, well, I'll never get elected president if I lose a war to a communist. Well, he did lose one, and the whole country went to hell in the process. So, and he lost, and the right took over. And they've never given up since. So you can think you're going one way, get your ass handed to you, but from a totally different direction.
Absolutely.
So it worries me, but anyway, I see and now we got the situation in the House. I don't know. I don't have a good description of what that is other than chaos. Yeah. But yeah, and also everyone, all my liberal friends tell me, you know, Trump, I hear all day long, Trump is dead. Trump is dead. He's dead. He's gone. Dead, dead, dead. He's a fool. No one's listening to him. Well, he apparently ordered the removal of the Speaker of the House, and it happened. So, you know.
I've got a word for you, John, on what's going on in Congress.
What?
Malfeasance.
Yeah, okay. We need Judge Roy Bean, I guess.
I mean, this is ridiculous. They have a job to do. They're not doing it.
Yeah, so?
They get paid big money.
I don't know.
They get pensions. They get benefits. They get all kinds of, you know, perks that we don't get.
Right.
And they're not taking care of business.
One of the things that Obama said that I really did agree with was, is that you get the president you deserve.
You know, one thing.
Is that true or not? It sounds true to me, but.
You know, one thing that I think is going on that I think is important is that all kinds of people now are beginning to figure a lot of this stuff out. And it really strikes me when, you know, MSNBC or CNN comes to the point of basically saying that Trump is a fascist and raising the whole issue of fascism. I mean, when's the last time that's happened? And I think that bringing that to the fore in people's minds is a really important step in fighting it. You know, for people to on news fronts to say that we have to start fighting fascism is incredible. I mean, the millions of people.
What do you think the IQ of the population is on the question of fascism? I mean, like, for example, you and I were raised and our parents, you know, lived through it in a whole epoch of it. But, you know, my grandkids, someone says, oh, that's fascism. And, you know, their memories aren't quite the same. Well, of course, Trump just ran for office, so maybe they'll have a clearer idea than we did by the time it's over. But you know what I'm saying? I wonder what the awareness of that is and how people easily affiliate themselves, apparently, certainly online, with all kinds of, you know, what look like quasi or neo-fascist things to me. It's all free speech.
Well, I have to tell you that my grandsons are 4 and 5, something like that. And they already know what fascism is, because when they hear the word, they can look it up right away. And they are already discussing the danger. To me, they're telling me, oh, this is dangerous. We got to do something about it. And I think that the latest technology, the way these young people pick up on these things is pretty incredible and also a very good sign of where we're going.
Yeah. That's, well, let's hope that the members in UAW are going to stand strong, at least certainly for now. And so I think that a positive outcome there, and with the Canadian, I think the Canadian workers are also wanting the same deal. So you got a cross border thing going here, and Biden's in a position now where even if he wanted to, I don't think he can say no to the labor now. So I think, you know, we got a chance to make a breakthrough on that. But I expect that the counterattack from big money, various factions of it, is going to be redoubled. You know, I remember, you know, once when at the conclusion of the when the UE won the election at General Electric in Ladson, South Carolina, a VP from General Electric, you know, came to the secretary treasurer of our union. His name was Red Block. Maybe you remember him. Great guy. Anyway, and said, and Red was teasing him about having won, you know, against the so-called impossible to beat machine of General Electric's industrial relations, right? And the guy, the VP, said, yeah, you got us there. You know, we've had, I think we've had 1,000 meetings on that situation. It says, brother, I don't think that's ever going to happen again. And it never did. So, you know, you can expect, at least not, we're in another wave now. I hope this organizing wave can, you know, put to bed the ashes of some of the past here and clean the slate.
Well, I don't know if this statistic is still right now, but it may have changed, but it wasn't that long ago that when they said that 60% of the people that could be in a union wanted to be in a union. And that was from polling.
No, I think not too long ago. Right. I remember that.
That's an incredible important force too. That, you know, and that's probably part of why we're seeing so many people come into unions now. I mean, I can't remember what it is, but the Starbucks workers just, well, I mean, they're organizing shop after shop after shop, but they also put in a national, anyway, I can't remember what it is, but they put in a national demand that's really going to change the playing field, I think. But I can't remember.
That's the national, to have a national bargaining situation order.
Yeah, no, I know about that one, but it was a different one. It was about they're calling on customers. I'm pretty sure what it is they're calling on customers not to boycott Starbucks because they want to make sure that the ones that are still working here are getting paid, kind of thing. So, you know, they're looking out for their potential members.
Well, and the national, let's talk about the national bargaining order, you know, or the national bargaining contract. So, for example, this would be a bold but key step that the NLRB could take, mm-hmm. which is to, based on a corporate-led campaign to crush a whole bunch of individual union victories and to in effect refuse to bargain with any of them, okay, that therefore you issue an order that you have to bargain not with them individually, which is how they won the elections, but bargain with all of them that actually won the elections, which would be 280 or something like that, right? Now, I think that's within the power of the labor board. They probably have to have a very strong finding of their, quote, there's no effective alternative, right, kind of thing, right? But, you know, that would be, we ought to get, yeah, you remember, you know, in the old days, it seemed like, remember when we had the National Lawyers Guild as like a left-wing, you know, bunch of a law firm kind of, or a law union, it would be, you need to get the lawyers working on these so you can make these ideas real, right? You're not going to get a bargaining order for all the ones that never had an election. That's not going to happen right now, but you might get one. You might be able to get one for the ones that you won, but they refuse to bargain.
Well, you know, the other union that's making the same demand is the Amazon workers are also.
I mean, is that situation improved from the crisis it was in?
Yeah, well,
seemed to be a problem there, but.
Well, actually, I don't know that, but they are demanding a national union, just like the Starbucks workers are.
Yeah, but they only won one election.
No,
Starbucks has won 275 or 80, something like that.
Well, actually, I think they've won more than one, but they anyway. But the thing I think is so important about both of those things is, if you look back in history, it was when the industrial unions were formed with the demand of a single contract that really revved up the labor movement all across the board and brought all kinds of people into the labor movement who weren't even in those industries. And it was just a big upsurge of organizing. And I think that's the same thing that's going on today with this demand for national contracts.
Right. Well, I hope so. Anybody, is that any legislative muscle behind that demand? I mean, that would have to be somebody. I mean, the labor board would have to issue an order. Unless you could strike them all for recognition, then, you know, or unless there was actually an effective national boycott or some economic force that the company was compelled to recognize, how else are you going to get them to do it?
Yep.
You may have to get them, you know, enough political muscle to get them to get the order.
Right.
You know, but.
But again, think about how inspiring that was when back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
But it was all kinds of people that form unions that weren't industrial unions. They were just unions.
Yeah, there was the Great Steel Strike. Of course, that one lost, but it gave birth to the idea, that's for sure. And Little Steel, which won, right?
Little Steel.
Yeah, that was, yeah, it wasn't so little, actually.
It wasn't.
And I know in the UE, General Electric, I guess the first national contract was in 37, yeah. It was the same year as Flint. But I don't know, was the first one in, I can't remember whether the first one was in Westinghouse or GE. Not sure. I have to come back and look, but. Anyway, the national contract makes it, you know, you have actual power, okay, with a big corporation. I mean, nothing else will work. I remember when Colt Industries, you know, bought the Fairbanks plant and Fairbanks Scales up in northern Vermont. And all of a sudden you're bargaining with, you know, a mini multi-billion corporation rather than, you know, a single entity in which the children of the founders were trying to run the company having trouble. So,
you know, I wanted to make another point about the UAW strike. Again, we've been organizing people to go to their rallies and go to their union hall. You know, they had these pre-strike picket practices, they called them, and they were huge. But one of the things that I think is different, that is so important, is, you know, this trend of bargaining for the common good, which basically says that unions can make demands for the communities that they're in, that kind of thing. The support for these for the Ford workers on strike is coming from neighborhoods, from churches, from all kinds of community organizations. They're taking food to the picket lines. They're doing everything they can to support it. And that's an even bigger coalition of people fighting on these, on these kind of things. And it's really having an influence. It's really changing things. And I want to say one last thing about the picket lines. The picket lines are so huge and so all over the entrances and stuff like that. But one of the things that's happening is you can hardly have a conversation with anybody on the picket line because of all the beeping and honking of cars and trucks going by.
Yeah, it's right.
Like a constant storm of sound. I mean, I can't even take it sometimes. I have to put it on earplugs. And but that just shows how much community support there is. And, you know, again, these are truck drivers. These are all kinds of drivers who are supporting them.
That's that. Well, that's, I think there's definitely a movement feel to the working class shrugging its shoulders, so to speak.
Right.
As Joe Pegorietto used to say, when the working class shrugs its shoulders, the temples of Wall Street will tremble. You know, he was a great veteran of the, I think, of the San Francisco general strike.
Mm.
And still, he was a retiree. He attended all the ILWU conventions, mm-hmm. and was usually invited to speak because he was good.
Yeah.
I don't think he was more than 4'5" at all. But man, he could talk.
Did you see where they moved the strike from Route 9 back to the plant?
Yeah, that's where I saw him last week. Yeah.
Yeah, did anybody say why?
Well, they wanted to. The only thing I heard was they wanted to consolidate where everybody was, you know, because they were having to communicate walkie talkies and everything, whatever. I don't know. I don't know the details of what the communication problem they were having that gave rise to that, but I don't know.
Yeah, because the visibility was so much better on Route 9.
Right. Well, they were, that's true. I don't know. Well, maybe somebody went after them. I don't know.
But I'm just wondering if the credit union kicked them out, and that would be pretty bad if that was the case.
Well,
I mean, it's their credit union.
Our mutual friend, who I won't mention, would know since he's the director of that bank. So,
I think I'm going to go up there today and find out.
So anyway, we'll be there. I might be up there before, but we're definitely going to be there on Friday and do a live show there with the guys.
Nice.
We can line
with Karen.
Well, yeah, because I think if we go back on a Friday, we were there Friday before, and so we'll see the same people. I'm assuming we'll see more of the same people. So last Friday, so
all right,
they won't not know what we're doing, you know, there. So.
but it's getting late, right, John?
It's getting late, but everything comes next. All right, guys.
All right.
Bye-bye.